Francesca Rhiannon, host of Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Writer's Voice, Mondays at 10 p.m. here on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport.
This is David Green with the Cultural Alliance of Fairfield County, welcoming you to our July edition of Spotlight on Arts and Culture, our monthly live interview show on WPKN 89.5 FM, bringing you news and information about the arts and culture across coastal Fairfield County, from Greenwich to Shelton. With more than 600 members, all the cultural institutions, organizations, and 270 individual artists, the Cultural Alliance is the connector, networker, and promoter for the arts and culture around our region. Today, we are talking about some really big news for Bridgeport, for the preservation community, for history, and for community and economic development. Actually, it's several pieces of good news surrounding the 1848 Mary and Eliza Freeman houses at 354 and 360 Main Street in Bridgeport's South End. To tell us the news and discuss some of the many implications of it, we have four guests in the studio today. First, Maisa Tisdale, Executive Director of the Mary and Eliza Freeman Center for History and Community, established in Bridgeport in 2009 to restore, preserve, and ensure the viability of the Mary and Eliza Freeman houses. Welcome, Maisa.
Hello, how are you today?
Great. We also have Wes Haynes, co-director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. The artist Jermaine, inspired by these houses and their histories, who has been working with Maisa to help tell their stories, and Laurie Heiss, steering committee member of our own Fairfield County Preservation Network, and the founding executive director and a current board member of the Merritt Parkway Conservancy. So welcome, everyone.
Hello, David.
And Maisa, so tell us all the great news. There's a lot of it, right?
There is a lot of great news, I'm happy to say. So first of all, a little while ago, we were designated one of the nation's 11 most endangered historical places. In essence, they were saying that we're also a historical treasure. The National Trust for Historic Preservation makes 11 of these designations a year. They've done it for 30 years. And they do it on the merit of the historical story that the particular site brings to the American people. And they also do it based on who needs the most help. So definitely we're endangered. Uh-huh. But we've also had some other good news. And that's that the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund has given us a grant of $50,000 to begin the structural work on the houses. And we also had more good news, which is that Connecticut Humanities gave us a $9,999 grant to help with building the capacity of the organization to carry on its mission.
Well, that's amazing news. Have you ever known a moment like this?
No.
That's pretty incredible. So tell us where these Freeman houses are and what kind of area are they in?
All right, so the Freeman houses are located in the south end of Bridgeport, so south of the railroad track, south of Harbor Yard, very close to Seaside Park. If people are familiar with the ferry, it's across from where the ferry parking lot has been.
Right, that's incredible. And so tell us briefly why anyone should care about these houses. Now they're 170 years old.
And they look it.
They're pretty bad shape. Why should anyone care about them?
Well, because these houses are just amazing. They may look very old, and I've seen the words ramshackled used about 100 times this week. If I have a dollar for every time, we'd be closer to our goal. But these houses are the last witnesses of a chapter of history that was unknown or forgotten until the 1980s, when Charles Brilovich, who was doing an architectural survey of the neighborhood, he wasn't yet the city historian, went to actually get his pants hemmed at the Cuban cleaners.
You're kidding.
And yeah, and he noticed that the actual cleaners and tailors was cobbled on to the front of some very old houses. And he just wondered, well, how old are these houses? So what he found out is that these houses actually were the last remaining structures that were on the same foundation, the original foundation of an 1822 seafaring African American community. And it was just mind-boggling.
Now, no one knew before 1980 that this was...
Well, if there was memory, it had been forgotten.
It had been forgotten
some time ago. And it's interesting because one of the other scholars who researches this topic, Dr. Jamila Moore Pugh, she found lots of evidence and information about this settlement actually in different archives. So she found a letter written to Frederick Douglass by one of the correspondents for his newspaper, and he was writing from a hotel that was once next to the houses. It's not there anymore. And he was writing about this amazing community of free people of color and how it was just the up-and-coming place for blacks.
So now the hotel isn't there. Nothing else is anywhere there. Have you any sense of how come these two houses...
There is one thing left. There's the church. Walter's AME Zion was one of the congregations. It's right now, I think the church that's there was built about 1890, but it's on 1848 foundation. But yeah, this entire community was basically lost to industrialization and also urban renewal. So... and also there was a recession and there was a civil war. So there were a number of things that brought this community to a slow and sort of waning and gradual end. But I guess the first thing that really started destroying the community was industrialization. So as the Civil War... forecasted the end of slavery, the industrialists in the area had to figure out how they would keep the economy of this area going, because all of the major banks and industries, farms and such, trains, they were indirectly connected to the slave trade. So when the slave trade started coming to an end, they had to figure out what to do next. And P.T. Barnum got the idea that Bridgeport should be the center of industrial innovation. So sort of an industrial Silicon Valley of its time. And he was looking for an area where the land didn't cost so much. And he started inviting factories to come in, and they started slowly but surely eating at Little Liberia. Plus, there was a recession at the time as well that made some people, they needed to sell. And then later on, we saw Bridgeport, because the factories were here, put utilities here, put public housing in the South End. But for some reason, these houses, they stayed. So they became, the reason that they're in bad shape is basically they were used as first immigrant housing after the Freeman sisters were there.
So that would be when?
This is like in about 1905. And what happened was the new owners didn't really care about the condition of the houses. They added some additions that weren't architecturally sound and started pulling at the fabric of the original buildings. Then later on, they became sort of absentee owners housing, and they didn't much care either. I won't call it slum housing. I mean, because families lived there and they raised their families there, but the absentee owners didn't keep them in the best of condition. So in the in the 80s, by the time, and into the 90s, by the time the houses were donated, they were donated just like you donate a car or something else. They were donated to the local anti-poverty program at the time, Action for Bridgeport Community Development, ABCD, like you'd, you know, give away an old car or boat or something like that. And they were in very, very poor condition because of their use as housing by absentee landlords.
Right. Let's to turn to Wes Haynes now. Wes, you're co-director of the Connecticut Trust. How did you first become aware of the Freeman Houses? Was it Charles Brilwich that alerted you to their importance?
Yeah, I've only been at the Trust for 5 years, and I've known of the Trust for of the Freeman Houses for 5 years. But yes, it was Charles's research. As soon as he got the National Register information out there, and the National Register is a report you do when you list a property that has unusual significance, that it makes it nationally significant. And Charles's research we published in our newsletter, the Trust newsletter, back in the 90s. And it sort of came on our radar at that point and became an important place for us to keep our eye on. But I only learned about them 5 years ago when the Trust was engaged in a funder of the deconstruction process, taking off the Cuban dry cleaners shop from the front of the Freeman Houses, removing it.
And was that during Maissa's tenure at the Freeman Center?
Oh, yes,
that,
yeah. Maissa has been, you know, every project has a champion, every project that succeeds. And Maissa has been the great champion of this, and she's brought the Trust into her knit this spider web that we can't get out of now because we're so enthralled by what she's doing.
Right. So tell me what the relationship is, maybe tell us a little bit more about the Connecticut Trust and what its relationship is to the National Trust, and then this list of 11 most endangered historic places.
Sure. The National Trust it was founded in the 1940s to do a couple of things. One was to protect buildings of national importance. This was before we had any federal policy for preservation. And one of the mechanisms they used was to buy properties and hold on to them. So Lyndhurst and Tarrytown, a number of great great estates are owned by them. We were created as the Connecticut Trust as a statewide. We're not really affiliated with the National Trust, but we parallel a number of their programs. One thing we don't do is we do not own properties. We work with we're a creature of the 1966 Historic Preservation Act, which basically said that the private sector really needs to bear the responsibility and the enjoyment of historic places. So we work with the owners and advocates like Maissa for the preservation of historic places. We do that in a number of ways. We provide technical assistance. We can, when times are fat, we can provide grants. We have a loan program, so we can pump money into a project as well. And we promote projects too as well. So we tend not to get involved with projects when they're in stable condition, but when there's a crisis, and historic places go through numerous crises in their lifetimes.
Right.
We tend to check in and work with the local community. We usually don't go it alone. We, in the case of the Merritt Parkway, many years ago, we did go it somewhat alone, and we were involved with that out in front of that issue. But with the Freeman Houses, we waited till a community assembled around the properties that really wanted to preserve them, and they're the ones that we provide sort of back office support for.
Right. So you basically wait for, if you like, an alert from a community organization. Otherwise, there would just be perhaps too much for you.
Yeah, we don't go out looking for trouble. we have enough of it coming in every day over the phone lines at the Trust.
Right. Now, tell us a little bit about this list that Maissa tells us that the Freeman Houses have been placed on.
The National Trust, one of the ways that they promote endangered properties is by maintaining a list, which they've maintained for 30 years nationwide. And they reach out to the local partners, such as the Connecticut Trust. They're a statewide organization similar to the National Trust in every state, and also regional and local, very, very local partners. For nominations of what you have that's the most endangered this year. And they get hundreds of applications for nominations each year, and they winnow through them. They're looking for projects that are not hopeless. So that was a very encouraging sign. I mean, these are reviewed by professional preservationists who have deep experience in saving properties. And so the fact that we made the list, the trust felt that this is not a hopeless situation. We felt that there's great opportunity here. But to have that endorsed by the national organization was really terrific.
Right.
But the list is properties that are, if nothing is done with them within a certain amount of time, we're going to lose these properties. And that's that was very much the case of the Freeman houses. They received a blight notice in this winter. It wasn't the first one they received. And part of the strategy to raise the profile so we could start getting money into this project. The project has suffered from lack of funding. And in Fairfield County, where we have a lot of resources, that's kind of appalling. So we needed to raise the profile of this property. So Maïssa and I put in the nomination, and we kept our fingers crossed, and we succeeded in making the case.
Right. So it's a real partnership. I mean, you, Maïssa, but you and the National Trust as well.
Yes, Maïssa's become one of my best friends in
this project. So just one other thing, and also about this list. You obviously work with buildings that have architectural merit, and we know, just thinking back to what you were saying about the National Trust, and it saved these classic buildings of great architectural merit in the country. But is it just that? Can you tell us a little bit more about buildings and structures that you work with? Are they just all of very high architectural merit?
No, I mean, you know, historic places, we work with historic places, and, and places can be important because they are great pieces of architecture. They can be historic because they tell great stories, and that's the case in the Freeman houses. I mean, this is a story that no other property in Connecticut, very few along the eastern seaboard, can tell, as well as the Freeman houses, because they are still standing after all these years. And as Maïssa walked us through the cycle of neglect that they felt when they became owned by absentee landlords, it's surprising that they're still standing. So, you know, we're working with Seaside, a children's home up the shore designed by Cass Gilbert. It's a state property. We're working with them. We've been working with downtown Norwich, the old department store, Reed & Hughes. We just put some loan money into that project to kind of jumpstart that after many years. We just worked very closely with New London Landmarks to save a very important commercial building on Bank Street. These buildings are all listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and so they've already been deemed by the state and the federal governments to be important. Our job is to just come in there and try to figure out how to get them to the next step into a position of economic viability.
And you have a pretty good success rate? I don't know.
We lose some. Sometimes, I mean, probably closer to home. One that we did lose recently was the Gustav Whitehead House. First in flight. He built a bungalow long after he had flown. It was in the town of Fairfield. The building didn't meet the criterion for it was too new a building for their demolition delay to kick in to buy us enough time to talk to the owner about possibly moving the building off the site and moving it to another site. So through our persistence, we got the owner developer to give us 2 days to go in there and document it. We did laser scans. We have complete record drawings of the house. We were able to salvage some of the pieces, but the house is gone, unfortunately. Right. So we don't win all the time, but even in those cases, we're able to go in and do some level of mitigation to keep a record of what was
and
important.
And the house now has still some kind of presence. I mean,
well, there's the pieces of it are in a museum and also on my computer right now.
Okay. So if you're just joining us, this is David Green with the Cultural Alliance of Fairfield County with our July edition of Spotlight on Arts and Culture, our monthly live interview show on WPKN 89.5 FN. With me in the studio today, talking about the 1848 Mary and Eliza Freeman houses in Bridgeport, South End, Maissa Tisdale, Executive Director of the Mary and Eliza Freeman Center for History and Community, Wes Haynes, Co-Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation, the artist Jermaine, and Laurie Heiss with the Fairfield County Preservation Network and Merritt Parkway Conservancy. Maissa, let's just turn back to you a little. Can you tell us about the Freeman Center? When was it formed and why?
All right, so the Mary and Eliza Freeman Center is actually an outgrowth of the movement to save the Freeman houses from demolition three times in the history of the houses since they were discovered as being of historical significance. The community has had to come together to save them from demolition.
So you have a pretty good track record, at least in saving them from being wiped out.
I'm still knocking on wood. But part of the issue is what you were talking about. People look at these houses and they see wooden houses. Mm. And they see old wooden houses and they just assume that they're not of historical value. What we're saving, what the Freeman Center is saving, is not just the architecture. It's actually more significant than that. We're saving a culture. We're preserving a culture. It turns out that the community called Liberia, that we now call Little Liberia, of which these two houses belonged, it was quite large. It covered approximately a 12-block area. It had almost 40 buildings of all different kinds.
When did that get started?
In 1822. This is while Connecticut still had slavery. This was while the U.S. still had slavery, while slavery was continuing around the globe. Mm-hmm. It was free people of color from Connecticut, Black and Pawtucket, who decided to create a community where people of Native American descent, people of African descent, people of mixed descent, so it was multi-ethnic people of color, could come and on American soil be free. So this was an extremely audacious statement to make in a time when the entire globe was saying that Black people were nothing more than chattel and Native American people should be nothing more than history.
Other examples of now, other Little Liberias?
That's what's so interesting. Mm. There were other Liberia communities with Liberia in their place name, all around the Atlantic. So Canada, Mexico, the Caribbean. All right. So one of our scholars, Dr. Moore Pugh, she wanted to know if they were connected at all or just by a spirit of freedom. And what she found is that they were very much connected and aware of each other, that they traded with each other, that they brought news to each other, and that they invested in one another.
That is extraordinary.
Yes. Of all those Liberia communities, we're the only one left with any kind of artifacts. Uh-huh. This community was also known as an underground railroad destination settlement, meaning that if people were seeking freedom, they could hide in plain sight. They could be taught a trade here. They could get on their feet and they could either continue to somewhere else or settle in this area. So of all of those communities that were in the hearts of urban areas, it's the only one that was not destroyed by urban renewal.
So the importance of this is growing in front of my eyes.
It is.
And it's not just the houses. It's not just the 12 blocks. Mm-hmm. It's really this community of free.
Right. And so the scholarly research has outpaced the actual restoration of the houses. So we wanted to find a way to bring that to people now. But the mission of the Freeman Center is actually to link the scholars to the community in a meaningful way so that we would have a museum and education and cultural center. So it would be a home of digital humanities for scholars who research these forgotten stories, right. And maybe they don't even get as much credit for these in their own institutions. But it's also a place for us to transmit this study in ways that are meaningful to ordinary folk, so that they understand and that they can make the knowledge of these stories part of their consciousness.
So you really have been. When was it founded? The center?
2009.
So you've really been working on several fronts.
Yes.
You've been working on the houses themselves, protecting them, but you've also been working to build an intellectual center,
right.
An academic center, arguing for their. So what about their impact on the. Your imagined impact on the future for this particular area?
All right, well, they've already had some impact. Whenever we work on the house, we make sure that we have a program that includes people from the area. Mm-hmm. So when we deconstructed the non-historic additions, we actually created a job program, a program that took displaced workers from Bridgeport and taught them preservation contracting. And that has a huge impact because that pays about 40% more than ordinary contracting. So people who have these skills can have a living wage and not just, you know, an entry-level wage. Mm. But what we found is we also trained whoever comes in contact with the houses, and in this case the construction workers, in the history and archaeology of the homes themselves. So the construction workers became docents and researchers, and they recovered the artifacts whole. And at that time, Nick Bellantoni was the state archaeologist, and he said any other crew would have brought those artifacts up in shards. But because this crew was so invested, because it related to them, their history, this sense of place, that they made sure that they were good stewards and researchers for this story. We've noticed that when people learn this story, it has an impact, an immediate impact, because there's a legacy, a local history that blacks never had anything or contributed anything, that native people didn't exist or they're not real. And so it addresses all of these issues. Plus, for other folks who are immigrants, they get to look at the kinds of forces that brought their own people, wherever they came from,
right.
to this same area. And this was a welcoming community for immigrants, if you look at it that way. People came from the Caribbean, they came from the South, they all worked together. They were welcomed, and the community reached prosperity based on the ambition and the inspiration of the people who settled there. So that's the story that the Freeman Center wants to tell. And we want to go beyond that and make sure that that the area doesn't fall victim to the same forces of urban renewal as other places have. Right. Mm-hmm. So we want to have development for the people who live there that honors the sense of place and the contributions that their people made, whether they were immigrants or native people or African American.
So who do you work with? You must obviously work with the city. How has the Freeman Center been working with the city of Bridgeport?
So the Freeman Center has been run by volunteers. We're all volunteers.
Right.
What we've done is we haven't had an operating budget. We've had project budgets, so we write a grant, and then when the time comes, we hire the staff that's needed for that grant. So we have had different partners over the years in terms of getting grants. The City of Bridgeport has been one. HUD has been one. The Connecticut Trust, the National Trust, and 1772 Foundation, now Connecticut Humanities. So we come together with these organizations. But right now it's time for us to make a transition. The project is large now, and we need to be professionally staffed. We can do the job, but we've never paid ourselves before.
Right.
So we need to get all of the folks who have been contributing to this effort under one roof and moving forward now in a way that actually allows us as an organization to sustain this entire effort.
And this is the moment, it
seems. This is the moment.
Well, thank you. If you're just joining us, this is David Green with the Cultural Alliance of Fairfield County with our July edition of Spotlight on Arts and Culture, our monthly live interview show on WPKN 89.5 FM. With me in the studio today talking about the 1848 Mary and Eliza Freeman houses in Bridgeport, South End, are Maissa Tisdale of the Mary and Eliza Freeman Center for History and Community, Wes Haynes, co-director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation, the artist Jermaine, and Laurie Heiss with the Fairfield County Preservation Network and Merritt Parkway Conservancy. I'd like to turn now to Jermaine.
Yes.
Jermaine, Maissa and Wes have talked a lot about the stories that these houses tell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're an artist living and with a studio in Norwalk, but mm-hmm. you've been pretty involved with Bridgeport over the years. Can you tell us a little about how you first became involved in this project with Maissa?
My involvement was, I think, more of a spiritual one. Mm-hmm. I think Maissa would agree. I had heard about, Little Liberia, tales and people talking about, that part of the South End. And my mother's side of the family is actually from Liberia. So when I heard, I started hearing more about these houses and, just sort of like, ghost tales about stuff that was going on over there. So I actually went seeking them out. And I saw the houses and I saw the plaques that were on the front talking about, their history as the oldest, constructions, the African Americans.
Yes.
And so I started doing some back research.
Huh.
And then I actually had a friend, I think Lizzie Rockwell. I think I reached out to Lizzie Rockwell and was a good friend of mine.
She's an artist.
Yeah,
too,
she's an artist. Yeah. She's a quilt maker and she actually works with. She has a quilting group of women that are, I believe, descendants of the quilters.
Down the Petway family.
Yes.
The Crossing. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'm so embarrassed.
Well, so it's a famous.
Just give me a second.
Yeah. It'll come back. Fine. So I just started doing my back research, and then somehow I was given Maissa's number, and I just reached out to Maissa just to sort of see where the project was, what was going on with the house, because in my mind, even just initially hearing about it and hearing some people talk about it, I'm wondering why nobody, especially African American people in Bridgeport, don't know about these houses, and there's not a stronger push to raise awareness about these houses, about Little Liberia as a community,
right?
The South End, everything that it just seemed like a direct opposite of the rap that the South End gets. Like just the history. Like if people knew the history about, what happened in this area and the houses, I think it would give a bigger sense of pride and just a bigger sense of direction for the people from the area and Bridgeport in general. So my angle was to somehow raise awareness and how could we get the story out,
right.
Even
uh-huh.
more. So I finally tracked down Maissa. we talked. She just happened to be in the process of, I believe, writing a grant or getting a grant to further, something that she already had, in motion with Jamila. So we put our heads together and started to curate what is, the art show that's up at Housatonic now.
So this was, a couple of years ago, would you
say? At least about 3 years ago.
So tell me about this idea of the show.
Okay,
exhibition.
So the show was mainly to tell the stories, to get artists' interpretations of the narrative that surrounded Little Liberia. Because I also, as a street artist, a person that, has been doing murals, legal and illegal, my whole life, I understand how, art affects people, just visual art, in the streets, sort of in your face, can direct the narrative of people's, ideas about art and
because it confronts people.
It confronts people.
Stimulates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A little bit of
thinking.
Both. Especially public art, whether you agree or disagree with it, it still opens the conversation. It still
right.
creates a platform for people to talk and discuss, multiple subjects. So I wanted to apply, my experience as a street artist and a muralist and a curator in general to creating a show that would then raise awareness, you know, about this project, and you know, just starting small and then seeing where we could go with it.
Right. So the show, I understand. Well, I've seen it. It's at the Housatonic Community College. Mm-hmm. Do you know about that? How that relationship started?
Well, that once again, you know, Maisa and I had started working on the project. And we had initially, you know, the show was going to, you know, take place, I believe, at the Bridgeport Library. But for whatever reason, that didn't work out. So Housatonic came on as a partner because, you know, obviously they believed in the vision and what we wanted to present. So that's how, you know, that connection came.
That's great.
Play.
And how far is the show?
Well, as of now, I mean, well, initially it was designed to be two phases, but it's really the first part is up now.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, I pretty much, you know, curated the show, but, you know, other artists came into play as we, you know, put the word out. But each individual artist in the show was given direction. It was, you know, loosely sort of packaged, but we wanted all the artists to either interpret, like, you know, past, present, or future concept of what, you know, Little Liberia meant to them. And what it could mean to the people that come to the show.
So you definitely had an ancestral connection. So
yes.
It was your story.
Yes,
as well as the Liberia story.
I think most of the artists that created work have some connection. Even if it's not ancestral, I think it's more of just like that story, just, you know, feeling an attachment to the importance of the story.
Who are some of the other artists?
Myself, Duvian Montoya.
Right. Who's a wonderful muralist.
Yes. Shauna, Aisha Nayala.
We have John Wright, an illustrator.
John Wright.
Out of Westchester. Mm-hmm. Rich Patton.
Rich, yeah.
I just wanted to mention that the quilter, Lizzie Rockwell, she was working with the Petways, who are part of the G's Bend.
Right. Yeah,
okay. They're part of the G's Bend quilting tradition, and they will be actually putting a quilt together also, literally stitching the Little Liberia experience back into being by in the form of a quilt.
G's Bend, mm-hmm. I couldn't think of that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, that sounds pretty amazing. Sort of what kind of stories do you feel these houses are telling? I mean, it's very much about the traditions of living, ways of working that people have forgotten today, the power of African-American community.
Exactly. I mean, I think just, you know, resilience, you know, just legacy. I mean, when I found out about the story, I sort of equated it to, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or, you know, just different, you know, communities that, you know, were founded by African-Americans that had their own banking systems, had doctors, had all the things that, you know, in current society, you know, the story is sort of told that there's a lot of, you know, different misconceptions that, you know, black people have not ever done, or, you know, or if we do them, it's the first time we've ever done them. It's 2018. No, we've been doing this since we've gotten here, but the stories have just been sort of wiped off or untold. So, I mean, I think, you know, this is still, you know, gives us an actual, you know, material, a physical place where, you know, these stories can be retold and people can see that you're standing on land where this actually happened. It's not like something that we're making up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Let me turn to our last guest today, Laurie High. Sorry you've had to wait, Laurie. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your involvement in these large preservation issues, which are partly, as we've learned, architectural and to do with physical buildings, but also about sense of place?
I guess I was born a preservationist when I took a job as the executive director of the Merritt Parkway Conservancy, and I learned a lot about just because you're listed on the National Register, it gives you the right to fight for it. and we have had to do that for the Merritt Parkway, for other buildings. I've networked with preservationists for the last 15 years, probably, mm-hmm. pretty actively. Helped form the Fairfield County Preservation Network in its second version.
Uh-huh.
And we work across boundaries and across towns and hopefully help each other. Personally, I've always been interested in old buildings. I bought a 1767 salt box in Newtown in the 80s.
Hmm.
When I first came to Bridgeport, I worked for GE at 1285 Boston Avenue, and I was the one standing on the corner crying when they knocked it down. I had always had a vision of that place being a thriving hub, artist hub. And, you know, I was with GE for many years, and I could never get traction on why that building needed to stay where it was and how important it was to the manufacturing legacy that started here. And, gosh, GE had a lot of money. You know, we could have done great things.
I would have supported you.
So,
can you tell us about this? Is before
that's
my
an
time.
Important building.
Can you tell me more about that building?
This was the most amazing building I've been in my life.
Really?
It was 20 sections long. It was built 5 stories high, bricks 5 feet thick, walls.
Wow.
Because it was built as a munitions factory.
And where was it?
For World War I. Uh-huh. 1285 Boston Avenue.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, fast forward, now I have an 1830 farmhouse in Reading, and, you know, I just deuced myself again, but I'm not on the board of the Conservancy now, but I advise them. I wrote a book on the Merritt Parkway Conservancy with Jill Smith, and we traipse around talking about why that road is important. At the same time, I've run to lots of preservation efforts. For example, in Reading, we tried to save the Charles Ives House, and we came so close. We came within $50,000 of being able to buy it. We had the Charles Ives Society out of Illinois. We had the Connecticut Trust was at our back. We had Reading Land Trust who wanted the land. We had the Reading Preservation Group. We had the town on board. We had money, and we were swooped in by an all-cash deal that was a little higher than ours out of New York. So, you know, it's not. I've been to this rodeo a few times, and you can see I have lost some buildings that have great meaning to me. But I'm delighted that you guys were listed. I know what it means when we were listed. It kind of brings a spotlight to your organization. It's good for grant writing. Also, it bolsters you, right? You need this for the next 10 years, right? You need what this is giving you. And we had members of the Conservancy, and I think it's sort of edifying for them to be part of something that's national. And so, like many people who will read about your story, I sat down and I read all 11 stories of the endangered places across the country, and I'm like, oh my God, this is a huge story. Wow, it's really late. But the fact that I've been by these places, you know, my kid played baseball, so we're always in Seaside Park. We go to the Vibes, you know, we're here back and forth. I'm like, I didn't know that. I kind of knew that the neighborhood was important, but I didn't know why. I kind of knew there was a remnant neighborhood that you would pass through and maybe go find a new restaurant or hang out. But
so this is the opportunity.
This is people like me who learn. And I've already told 3 people the story. I didn't know that. What did you call it? I'm like, look it up. Look up. Okay, Little Iberia. There's a story here. But remember, I turned around and wrote a book on it. So you and I may have
a book. We need to write a book.
Deal day, right here.
Let's go back to this list. I know, Wes, you went through the list at the event the other day at Housatonic. Could you maybe tell us some of the other places that the Freeman Houses are in company with?
This is a really big deal, this recognition, as part of the 11. And this is a really great list that the National Trust, you know, put together as a result of a lot of community engagement throughout the country. You know, probably the headliner on this is that Mount Vernon, Washington's home, is one of the house on the list.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it kind of reminded me that house, Mount Vernon, at the time that the Freeman houses were occupied and in really almost mint condition because they were only 10 years old, Mount Vernon. We were in danger of losing in the 1850s Mount Vernon. Huh. The kind of Maissa Tisdale of her day, who is considered the founding mother of preservation in the United States, and Pamela Cunningham, pulled together what she called the Mount Vernon Ladies Association. It is the first big save of a great American place, as kind of the preservationist, American preservationist origin story. That was in the 1850s. Yeah, and it was the same thing. The building was the Washington family who inherited it couldn't support the building anymore. The federal government didn't want to, they didn't have any vision to go. So government didn't want to get involved and invest in it. And it was basically a private sector fundraising thing. I mean, we joke about a lot of bake sales, but they actually went out to public subscription throughout the country. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, there's hope in that that story. What's endangering Mount Vernon right now is development that's outside of the property, but it's in its view shed, and it's going to change the whole context. But just to run really quickly through them. There was a house of a former enslaved person in the Isaiah T. Montgomery House in Mound Bayou, Mississippi, was one of the 11 most endangered. The Dr. Susan LaFleche Picot Memorial Hospital in Omaha, which served Native Americans, is also endangered. And hurricane damaged historic resources in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. I mean, basically, the National Trust said the entire place is endangered. Walkout schools of Los Angeles, where Chicanos staged a walkout in Los Angeles, was one of the places, or actually five of the schools. The Ship on the Desert is in Salt Flat, Texas. It's a mid-century modern building
that is definitely in
poor condition. The Ashley River Historic District outside of Charleston in South Carolina, that is sort of the kind of area that the National Trust owns several properties, but there's changes in zoning proposed that could really unleash development that will be in everybody's face there. Annapolis' City Dock area, so that's generally a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The Larimer Square in Denver, also a downtown district. Wow. And Route 66 from Illinois to California has been designated as on that list. You know, the list has a really good track record. In the 30 years it's been around, they've only lost 5% of the properties that they've
that's
listed.
That's incredible.
And so that comes to 15 out of about 300 properties that have been designated such.
So the Route 66 is a great segue back to Laurie to talk about a little bit more about the merit. Can you just tell us a little bit about the merit, how the conservancy was organized, and what the impact of being on the list was, what it caused? So when was the conservancy founded? And why?
The Conservancy was founded in 2001.
Oh, so fairly recently.
It was. Although there have been various Save the Merit and Merit Preservation and Merit Parkway commissioned throughout the history of the 75 years of the Merit Parkway. It is really a road that the people fought to build and then fought to save and fought to control and keep, and then fought to keep the way it is. Hmm. The Conservancy being the latest iteration of that.
I see. Yeah.
And Peter Malkin took the head from Emil Frankel. Emil Frankel was a DOT commissioner, and he was also a really thoughtful person, a lawyer. And when he retired from that position, he turned around and formed the Merritt Parkway Conservancy
and got
Peter Malkin involved.
In my head, I always imagined that DOT was probably the enemy.
They are the enemy.
Oh, but it was great. But it was created by a former DOT commissioner.
After he left, he realized it was a gem. He's a very thoughtful person, realized how important it was to Fairfield County and what it meant. And when he was out of that official public role, he started it. He was then called off by the federal government to go back into the transportation segment, and he had to not run it, not stay with it, but turned it over to Peter Malkin and Dee Winokur. And it's been pretty active since then. And, we had a precedent-setting lawsuit against the state of Connecticut DOT and the Federal Highway Administration because they were going to knock down three bridges on the historic register with a road project. And the law says that you absolutely, if you're using any public funding, which they were, have researched and come up with absolutely no alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually wasn't the case. And we could prove it. And they actually even proved it themselves in court. But, you know, it's a slog.
Right. Right.
And Connecticut Trust and five other organizations came on as, what are we, co-plaintiffs?
Yes, co-plaintiffs. We were all co-plaintiffs in that one.
Yeah. And we had help from the National Trust, and we had fabulous attorneys. But you have got to be willing to stand up for your property that's listed.
And enforce
the rules
key to this too.
That are there to help you. And then we got great partners, and we had a wonderful judge, and we won.
So what would you say the impact of being on this list of the 11 was for the merit?
That came after the lawsuit.
Yeah.
But what it did, kind of three things. So it really does reinforce the people who have been working on it. You know, at that point in time, Jill was the executive director. It helps the board. It brings attention. You do a press conference on the bridge. The DOT commissioner has to come, and someone from the governor's office and the National Trust. You know, the DOT guy is kind of forced into saying pretty good things about what they're going to do for the Merritt Parkway.
Right.
It brings grant money. It's easier to get grant money. Your members are going to give more money.
So it's really a spotlight. Everybody has to come into the spotlight. And,
right. And DOT, you know, has tried to be a good partner.
Good.
I think they understand that if something gets national attention, which is what you've got, you don't want to be the person that kind of stands in front
and
of that.
And it's pretty amazing just being a driver on the Merritt a lot. I mean, it really is a living, breathing organism in a way, and it's always changing, and the number of elements that can change for good or ill are pretty
endless.
Many. Remarkably, we have 3 minutes left. I just wanted to ask you all about your sense of the future of the Freeman houses, both near term and long term. I guess I should start with Maisa, but don't take all 3 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to try to talk quickly, and so I might not answer exactly that question. But what I want to say is that if love alone could restore those houses, they would have been restored a long time ago.
Right.
But what we're lacking is money, and that's really significant for us because they're really just a couple of wooden houses. Houses like that get restored every day of the week. But Bridgeport is the second poorest city in the state. And it would take a family with two children would need to make $73,576 a year just to have transportation, childcare, housing, food, and medical costs in Bridgeport. We know that our families don't have that. All right, 100% of the children in Bridgeport are entitled to get free lunch. That's how poor the city is.
Yeah.
So this endangered listing, it lets us raise our story to a national level where we can get funding to keep this going. And also because African American and Native American stories are so unknown and often so doubted that the National Trust says, yes, this is a story. It is real. That's really important to us. So, yeah, we think we're going to succeed.
Thank you. Any last words from anyone else?
Yeah, I have a project, in another project in Bridgeport for Wes. It's the West End Branch Library. And guess what? It is slated for demolition.
Is it really?
Take it away, Wes.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
It never stops. It never stops, right?
But on a happier note, I see a very positive future for Freeman. I see that they're going to look a lot better on the outside within a year or so. And if you want to see their future, look to Weeksville in Brooklyn. Basically, a very parallel story to the Freeman Center. Brooklyn was in the same sort of state that Bridgeport is today when that project started over 30 years ago.
Yeah. Jermaine?
I second that. I've actually been to Weeksville, and it's like the perfect model for what, you know, Little Liberia could be. And, you know, for the future, I could just see it definitely restoring a sense of pride, you know, in the people of Bridgeport and African-American and people, you know, all around, definitely.
So this is a very exciting moment. So thank you very much, all of you, for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And this is David Green with the Cultural Alliance's Spotlight on Arts and Culture on WPKN. Signing out. And to remind you to, within 3 days, there should be a podcast of this broadcast if you missed it or if you want to share it with your friends and colleagues. So this is David Green signing out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for WPKN comes from the Great South Bay Music Festival presenting Allman Brothers founding member Dickie Betts and his band, plus Electric Hot Tuna, the Devin Allman Project, Little Feet, Sublime with Rome, The Dirty Heads, Humphreys McGee, Papa Dozio, and over 65 performers on 3 stages, plus an arts and crafts market, beer and wine garden, and kids zone, July 12th through the 15th, Shorefront Park in Patchogue on Long Island. More information and tickets at GreatSouthBayMusicFestival.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Gallagher, host of Digging in the Dirt. Join me later today at 5 p.m. when my guest will be Mary DeMocker, author of a new book entitled The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. That's Digging in the Dirt with Mary DeMocker coming up later today here on listener-supported WPKN.
Acknowledge climate change is changing our planet as we know it? Can you accept that this is irreversible? Have you found a way to live with this? Dugald Hine and Doc Mountain thinkers may have. Please tune into Tidings on Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. for more. This is Hazel Khan. Thank you.
Sunflower mazes to tubing in Connecticut rivers. Learn how to have fun in the sun and learn some tips for greening your vacations. Tune in Saturday, July 14th at 9 a.m. for Living the Green Life. Hear from Randy Fiveash, director of the Connecticut Office of Tourism, to learn what you can do in Connecticut over the summer and year-round. And for future shows, listen every second Saturday at 9 a.m. for Living the Green Life.
On Thursday, July 19th, the Bridgeport Pride Celebration kicks off with the same-sex exhibition and ticketed reception that includes refreshments and a DJ from 5:30 to 8 p.m. And then the party continues with a free Pride Walk from the colorful Broad Street steps to a loop around McLeavy Green. But the night is still not over. At 8:30 p.m., doors open at the Bijou Theater in downtown Bridgeport for a one-of-a-kind dragon variety show. Tickets for both the same-sex reception and or the same-sex variety show at the Bijou are strongly encouraged via citylightsgallery.org. Proceeds from the variety show will benefit 2 nonprofits, the WPKN Community Radio and City Lights Gallery.
Hi, I'm Terry Smith, Creative Director at Franklin Streetworks. We're a nonprofit contemporary art space and cafe in Stamford, Connecticut. We curate 3 group exhibitions each year, and many address social issues such as immigrant rights, LGBTQ themes, and the environment. We have shown more than 350 artists from around the world, including many emerging artists who have gone on to show at major museums such as the Whitney Museum of American Art. Our exhibitions and educational programming are free and open to the public. More information is at our website, franklinstreetworks.org, or on our Facebook page.
Creative Arts Workshop, located in New Haven, Connecticut, has been serving artists of all ages and abilities since 1961. Creative Arts Workshop provides programs in book arts, painting, photography, printmaking, and more. More information about the Creative Arts Workshop is available at www.creativeartsworkshop.org or at 203-562-4927.
Hi, my name is Carla Misklos, and I'm the Executive Director of Operation Hope, located in Fairfield, Connecticut. Operation Hope has been in the community for over 25 years, working to end hunger and homelessness for our neighbors in need. We offer a comprehensive shelter program for men, women, and families. We serve lunch and dinner every day to anyone who is hungry in the community. We operate a food pantry that provides basic staple items for those who are struggling to make ends meet. We own and operate 46 units of safe, affordable housing that comes with support services, and we provide clinical support and daily living skills counseling to those we serve. Our talented staff and numerous volunteers are witness to the power of people coming together to support those in need who just need an opportunity for change. If you'd like to help or for more information, please visit our website, www.operationhopect.org, or call us at 203-292-5588.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, host of Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Writer's Voice, Mondays at 10 p.m. here on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport.